Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. We're going to switch around the agenda just a little bit. We're going to start with the Department of Commerce. And today we're just going to focus on the telecommunications part of commerce. And we've already heard the energy portions of the Commerce Department. And we have Diane Wells. And, well, I think you're the main show today. So welcome to the committee. And we also have Tim Janke and Rochelle Garrow listed as resources, so they are here.
That's correct.
Great.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide comments today. As the chair indicated, my name is Diane Wells, and I'm here to provide you with some background on the telecommunications division within the Department of Commerce and to touch on our budget. I also have with me today Tim Janke, who's the department's financial management director. And Rochelle Garrow, who is our TAM, Telecommunications Access Minnesota Administrator, if you have specific questions in those areas that they could better address. From a high-level overview, the Telecommunications Division represents the public interest in matters before the Public Utilities Commission, helps regulate the state's telephone industry, and administers the Telecommunications Access Minnesota, or TAM, program. To explain in more detail what we do, I'd like to cover how the state is structured with regards to regulating telephone service in Minnesota, and then describe the industry, the technologies, and conclude with activities that the department is involved with. First of all, Minnesota's regulatory structure is different from most other states. In the vast majority of states, the advisory and advocacy staff all reside within what's called the Public Utilities or Public Service Commissions. In Minnesota, the legislature, back in 1980, separated the advisory staffs and the advocacy staffs, with the advisory staff staying with what became the Public Utilities Commission, and the advocacy staff moving to what was then the Department of Public Service. What this means is that when the Public Utilities Commission has an issue in front of it for decision, the commissioners can go to their advisory staff and discuss the issues without having to worry that the person they are talking to may have testified or advocated in a similar proceeding for a specific outcome. In Minnesota, we don't have to create that wall to separate advisory and advocacy staff on pending issues because we're in separate agencies. And what we have at the Department of Commerce is the advocacy staff representing the public interest in matters before the commission. The department is considered a party to proceedings, so we don't have ex parte communications with the commission. And the department, in addition to being a party in proceedings, also is the investigative and enforcement arm of the commission to make sure that commission orders, rules, and state law are followed. With that in mind, I'd like to turn to the telecommunications industry in Minnesota. We have in the state 96 incumbent telephone companies, including Quest, which is our largest landline company, Embark and Frontier, which are mid-sized, and small companies that range in size from Hickory Tech, which serves the Mankato area, down to Northern Telephone Company, which has less than 50 access lines and serves the area near Wawena. We have approximately 340 companies that are authorized to provide long-distance service in the state, like AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, Quest, and smaller companies like 360 Networks, AceLink, and Techstar, and we call those inter-exchange carriers, or IXCs. We have about 175 competitive local exchange carriers, or what we call CLECs, that offer local telephone service in competition with the incumbent providers. Some of these local competitors continue to rely on the incumbent provider to get that last mile to the end user customer. Some have completely overbuilt the incumbent territory, and others use the incumbent's network and resell or lease piece parts. All of the incumbent local telephone companies, the competitive local exchange companies, and the long-distance companies have received certificates of authority to provide service in Minnesota by the Public Utilities Commission, and they all have tariffs on file. Turning to the telecommunications history, prior to 1984, the incumbent local telephone companies provided all of the local service in Minnesota, and AT&T provided all of the long-distance service. In 1984, we had the divestiture of AT&T, and long-distance competition started to take off with companies like MCI and Sprint entering the market to compete against AT&T. In 1996, at the federal level, the Telecommunications Act was passed, and that provided structure to and stimulated the growth of competition for local telephone service. This very brief history of the telecommunications industry guides the regulatory framework in Minnesota. We have many laws that go back to the early 1900s that still address how companies must provide local and long-distance telephone services. For example, that companies must interconnect their networks and that discrimination is prohibited. For those of you that have been around a while, you might remember working on some of the more recent laws that have come about that cover how the competitive providers are regulated and how lesser regulation applies to the incumbent telephone companies, that update the state's goals with regard to telecommunications services, that address the administration of programs like TAM and TAP, the Telephone Assistance Plan, and that incorporate consumer protections such as the requirement that there be an annual notice of all service options available mailed to customers, credit for incorrect directory assistance, customer authorization to provide to change a local or long-distance provider, and types of third-party charges allowed on bills. In addition to the growth of competition, we've had many, many changes in the technology in the field of telecommunications. Today, some customers no longer use a landline phone to communicate, but have cut the cord and do all of their telephoning with their wireless phone. Wireless providers receive their licenses from the FCC, and by law, their rates are overseen by the FCC. Consumer protection issues, aside from the rates charged, are today largely addressed in the contracts between the wireless companies and their customers. A second area of advancement has been in the growth of broadband service, generally provided by a telephone company as DSL, or fiber to the home, or by a cable company as a cable modem. Broadband service has been classified as an information service by the FCC, so broadband rates, speed, or availability are not regulated at the state level. A broadband connection is necessary for the most recent method to communicate by voice, and that's voice over internet protocol or VoIP phone service that's offered by companies like Vonage. In Minnesota, we have a court ruling that nomadic VoIP service is not a regulated telephone service, and nomadic VoIP is where you can move your VoIP phone service with you as you travel. The regulation of fixed VoIP service is still in dispute, and we are awaiting decisions by the FCC and probably the courts. This is an important matter as we see more and more calling moving to VoIP. In terms of broadband service, I shouldn't forget to mention that broadband service can also be gotten from satellite-based providers such as DirecTV, EchoStar, and WildBlue, and then Wi-Fi offerings made available both by private niche providers in the state and some municipalities, and then we have wireless broadband offered by cell phone companies. Now, with all of these service types and technologies available, and with state regulatory authority limited to landline telecommunications services, you may be wondering exactly what the Department of Commerce's responsibilities are in the area of telecommunications regulation. Briefly, all regulated companies are required to keep their current rates on file. The department processes approximately 1,500 dockets a year addressing rates or conditions of service. The Telecommunications Act of 1996 gave responsibilities for overseeing the interconnection agreements between companies to the states, and the department is involved in reviewing these agreements, and in instances where the interconnecting companies cannot agree, we serve as a party to disputed matters that are heard by an ALJ and decided by the Public Utilities Commission. For example, we recently had two staff members testifying in a contested case between Quest and Charter. All new entrants in the state must receive certification before entering the market, and the department does the review to make sure that the applicants have the financial, managerial, and technical ability to provide service. And companies must also have 911 plans, tariffs, and interconnection agreements filed and approved. Additionally, all mergers and acquisitions where the ownership of the regulated company changes must be reviewed and referred to the PUC for a decision. For example, we submitted comments to the Public Utilities Commission, and they recently approved the merger of CenturyTel and Embark in Minnesota. Carriers wishing to obtain public subsidies from the Federal Universal Service Fund must be certified annually at the state level, and the department does that investigation. Consumer complaints regarding telephone service go to the Consumer Affairs Office of the Public Utilities Commission for mediation. However, if the complaints are indicative of a systemic problem with a provider, the department would conduct the investigation. There are also many miscellaneous filings dealing with issues such as promotions, rate changes, access charges, directory assistance, boundaries, extended area service that the department investigates. And finally, much of our time is spent assisting the resolution of disputes between the interconnecting companies. Those are the department's core regulatory responsibilities. However, legislation passed last session also brought the department more actively into the area of broadband, although not in a regulatory role. First, Commerce Commissioner Glenn Wilson serves on the Ultra-High-Speed Broadband Task Force, and the department also provides staff to that task force. The task force is made up of a cross-section of broadband providers and users. It has been meeting since July and will be submitting a report November 1st. And in its report, it'll address issues such as a recommended connection speed needed by all residents by 2015, a description of policies and actions necessary to achieve that goal, how the public and private sectors can operate, the costs to reach that goal, and an evaluation of how broadband can benefit education, healthcare, community-based organizations, and government. Also, due to legislation passed last session, the department is involved with a broadband mapping project for Minnesota. The department contracted with a nonprofit called Connected Nation to map broadband availability in the state. That project will tell us where, geographically, we have no broadband available, where we have one provider, and where we have multiple providers, and also the speed of broadband at a county level. The preliminary maps were released the first week in February, and Connected Nation was here to present those maps and answer questions before the Senate Energy, Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee on February 5th. Connected Nation also has a website for Minnesota at www.connectmn.org, where residents can currently go to test their broadband speed or fill out a form indicating that they don't have broadband available. Residents can also type in their address and be hot-linked to any provider serving that area. Now, these maps will continue to be fine-tuned through June with information from providers and users. The broadband maps will also help us identify areas where projects can be found to possibly qualify for federal economic stimulus funding, which is allocated $7.2 billion for broadband, with the Rural Utility Service within the U.S. Department of Agriculture having $2.5 billion for loans and grants, and the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, or NTIA, of the U.S. Department of Commerce having approximately $4.7 billion for grants to bring broadband to unserved or underserved areas. And turning to our budget, you can see for fiscal year 2010-2011 that the Commerce Telecom budget is $2,020,000, and this is all fee-funded, so it's recovered from the telephone companies. And it's the same budget that we've had for fiscal year 08 and 09. And then turning to the Telecommunications Access Minnesota program, which is within the telecom division, but its numbers are not reflected in the budget numbers you just saw. The purpose of that program is to provide telecommunications access for Minnesotans with hearing, sight, speech, and physical limitations. And we do this by providing specialized telecommunications equipment, the relay service, and outreach services. And TAM is funded by 6 cents a month surcharge on all telephone lines, wireless, and wireline. And the TAM budget for the next 2 years, you'll see there are some direct transfers out of that fund for rural captioning to do DHS, to the Accessible News for DEED, and then to the Commission of Deaf, Blind, and Hard of Hearing Minnesotans. And then we have just under $800,000 for administration, $6 million for the relay, and $4 million for equipment distribution. And, for example, of what TAM does, in 2008, the relay averaged 67,630 calls per month and provided equipment to 1,566 new participants, almost 1,200 repeat participants, and then repaired or replaced equipment to almost 1,400 participants. So that's what I have on the Telecommunications Division, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Wells. Are there questions? Senator Hand, was your hand up?
No, I'm sorry.
Does the department handle consumer complaints?
Madam Chair, if a consumer has a complaint about their telephone service, it would go to the Consumer Affairs Office at the Public Utilities Commission, where it's tried to be mediated. If there are several complaints coming in on the same topic, the commission would refer that to the department for investigation.
Does that apply to cell phone complaints?
Madam Chair, the wireless service in Minnesota is more of a contract issue, so those are referred to the Attorney General's office.
Are there other questions? Senator
Madam
Fredrickson.
Chair, Ms. Wells, I, when you were talking about your budget, I didn't hear everything you were saying. I see there's a $1,100,000 appropriation each year. Is that generated by fees or is that from the general fund?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, that is generated from fees that we indirectly assess back to the telephone companies based on their intrastate revenues.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Ms. Wells, for the current biennium, there are zeros on the sheets that were distributed to us. What was your budget last year, or in this current biennium?
For fiscal year 2000, Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson, for fiscal year 2009, the budget for the telecommunications division was $1,010,000, and that does not include the TAM fund. That's operated separately.
Madam Chair, Ms. Stanton, what is the expenditure for TAM, and where are those funds arrived at from?
It's a new division.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson, I'm sorry, was your question where the TAM funding comes from?
Yes.
That's a 6 cent a month surcharge on wireline and wireless telephone bills. And I also have Mr. Johnke informed me that it shows zero on, because we moved it out of the energy budget, the OES budget. That's why it's zeroed out there in previous papers you might have seen. Sorry.
And what's, did you say what the balance is in the TAM fund as well?
I'd have to refer that question to Ms. Garrow.
Is she here?
Yep. Madam Chair, the fiscal year 08 balance was $3,060,000, and the estimate for 09 is $2,189,000.
How much of that is usually spent every year for required purposes?
Madam Chair, we're trying to draw down the account. That's why the surcharge is at 6 cents. So it looks like, are we running a negative? Yeah, we're drawing down close to $700,000 in fiscal year 08, and $870,000 is the projected drawdown in fiscal year 09.
So it's still going to maintain for a while at that rate. And 6 cents is the lowest rate? I'm trying to remember. We go through this every year, and I apologize if I forgot exactly how that works.
Madam Chair, the TAM fee can be as high as 20 cents a month. We try to run it so that it's just funding it by the year. Of course, there are a lot of expenses in, for example, July, when the money is paid out to DHS Deed and the Commission for Deaf and Hard of Hearing. And then there's also an expectation that the FCC may shift some of the video relay expenses, which they're, and the internet protocol expenses, which they're currently covering 100%. There's some expectation that some of those costs will be shifted back to the state. So we don't want to be caught totally flat-footed.
Do you have any idea what those would be? How much?
Madam Chair, if the expenses were shifted to the state for fiscal year 2008, that it would have been an additional $6.25 million. The per-minute charges for the relay, the video, are much more expensive than the relay that we operate.
So, looking at page 6 of the governor's budget pages, it lists, I guess, 0809. It lists the balance for TAM as in the $5.7 million a year for the expenditures.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it should sync up pretty closely with this slide, which is the two-year.
We can't read that, but okay, you can maybe tell us what the different colors are. I can at least see the color wedges.
Approximately half of the circle is in blue, and that is for the relay service, and that's $6 million for the 2 years. The purple, which is a little over a quarter, is the equipment distribution, and that's $4 million. The administration is in peach, and that's $788,000, or 6%. The direct transfer out to the Minnesota Commission for Deaf and Hard of Hearing is $600,000, and that's 5% of the fund. There's $200,000 that, or up to $200,000 that goes to Deed for the accessible news service. That's where the if you can't read a newspaper, you can call in and have it read to you, and that's $200,000 for the 2 years, and then Rural Captioning has a $600,000 allocation, or 5% of the fund, which goes to DHS, and that's for the closed captioning on some of the outstate television stations that aren't network affiliated.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And do you have, is there federal stimulus money for broadband that is coming to the state or that you could apply for?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, We're watching that very closely, as is Deed, as is the governor's office, and I try to keep your committee administrator, Will Seufert, and in the House, John Reich. Well,
ours is Don Jarofsky, but, the policy committee's administrator.
I'm sorry, Senator Pertner Solon's committee administrator, Will Seufert. Up to date on what's going on, the NTIA started holding meetings this week in Washington. There's a joint meeting that'll be video streamed on March 10th with the RUS, the NTIA, and the FCC to talk about how the money will flow. There is no amount allocated to Minnesota specifically. The only requirement is that there be at least one project per state. So we're still waiting to see what role the states might have. We think they'll look to us, especially since we have the broadband mapping project done, but whether they aggregate the projects for Minnesota that are applied for with them and send them back to us to be vetted and ranked. We just don't know. We're watching. We don't know how much they're going to be able to staff up to spend that money. So we're just tracking it very closely at this point.
Ms. Wells, I'd ask that you keep Mr. Jarofsky and Mr. Mueller, our fiscal analyst, informed about that, too. That would be helpful. So
Thank
we're
you.
All on the same page. All right. Other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, members, I think we'll do the LCCMR bill next, and then we'll just continue with our budget after that. Where did Dennis go? He's just moving with the constituents, so he'll be right back.
But the rest of it, I mean, that's what the money is to be used for.
Well, the letter I got from detail, several paragraphs, so at least.
Next on the agenda, Senate File 1012, Senator Anderson.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. And this is the LCCMR funding bill for the year. And I'm proud to present this bill to the committee today and remind the full committee that all five of the Senate members of the LCCMR are part of this division and are all here today. Senator Vickerman's the chair on the Senate side. Senator Fredrickson, Senator Parisot, Senator Chaudhry, and myself are the Senate members. So we all participated in many, many hours of first putting together an RFP and then hearings and then putting together our allocations. So this is what we'd like to recommend today to the Senate for passage. And we do have the LCCMR's biennial report overview as well. Maybe what I'll do is go through the bill and then see how much time we have if we want to just have general discussion or comments about the report. We can do that as well. With me is Susan Thornton, the Executive Director. Is that your title?
Director.
The Director of the LCCMR, who's going to help me in areas where I may be fuzzy. So I'm going to go through the bill page by page, and I would also ask you to look at the summary sheet, which is a legal-sized sheet that breaks down the different funding recommendations into categories, so it's kind of helpful to get your head around how we're dividing up the money, the categories. Maybe I should start with that, and then I'll go through the bill. So the summary shows the dollar amounts out of a total of $26.1 million available for us for this year. As you'll recall, the LCCMR is a one-year process at this point, so that's this year's spending. It breaks down into natural resource data and information, land habitat and recreation, water resources, aquatic and terrestrial invasive species, and energy, as well as a small portion for administrative costs. And you can further break that down into outcomes. The land pieces are divided into acquisition and restoration. Some of the acquisition is fee title acquisition. Some is in the form of easements. Permanent easements are the only kind of easements we ever fund. And some of them are restoration activities. There's research analysis. Research and analysis, inventory and foundational data, information, environmental education and outreach as well. So that sort of gives you some of the categories. Let me go through and tell you what the specific projects are. Before I forget, I also should introduce the other folks who are here. We have three LCCMR members who are here, as well as some more of the staff. So I want to introduce them. Nancy Gibson is one of the citizen members. Jeffrey Broberg is one of the citizen members, and we're really glad they're here. We also have we had Representative Ron Szymanski,
yes,
who is a newly elected House member and newly appointed to fill one of the seats on the LCCMR from the House side. So he was here, which was nice. I guess he had to leave. And we have two more of the staff from the LCCMR here with us as well. Is there anyone else I need to introduce? Okay. Let's go through the bill. As I mentioned, the total is a little over $26 million that's available for this year. I'm just going to go through and point out the individual projects that we're recommending funding for, describe them very briefly, and go through it all, and then see if there's questions about any of the specific proposals. Some of these are ongoing projects that the LCCMR has funded more than once, and some of them are new ideas. So I'll just point that out as we go. First, on the bottom of page 2, the county biological survey, and that's something that we have funded a number of times to try to finish that in a statewide to survey significant species from county to county. On page 3, funding for creating county geologic atlases, and in particular, testing of aquifers and groundwater around the state to try to do more mapping of those resources to know what we have, which we need to do before we can do a better job of protecting them. County soil survey mapping and web-based data delivery of that information. And then at the bottom of page 3, another continuing project, which is to map spring sheds for cold water trout streams to figure out where the water goes in and figure out impacts on these trout streams from development and water use appropriations. Line 4.9, we're proposing funding to Ducks Unlimited to do a mapping of wetlands that have been drained but are restorable. So an inventory and mapping and digitizing of drained, restorable wetlands across Minnesota. The bottom of page 4, we have an allocation recommended for state parks and for metro parks. On page 4, it's state parks for acquiring inholdings or land that could be added to complement existing boundaries of state parks. On the top of page 5, an acquisition proposal for acquisition of a segment of land for the Willard-Munger Trail in Washington County, and another acquisition piece in Bemidji for the Paul Bunyan State Trail. After that, on 5.8 is the acquisition proposal for the Metro Parks for acquisition of land, again, within the park boundaries. The bottom of page 5, we have a recommendation to acquire high-quality native plant or high-quality pieces of land that have native plant and rare features and to restore those in scientific and natural areas. So that's for acquisition for those. Yeah, that's for acquisition for SNAs. And then on 6.5 is the Habitat Conservation Partnership, which is a large number of partners, nonprofit partners, and state agency partners that work together on projects to acquire and restore lands across greater Minnesota. And then we have a Metro Partners proposal on page 7 that starts on line 7.29 that is a similar partnership in the metropolitan area that is a number of different proposals put together by these partners to prioritize land projects, land acquisition and restoration projects in the metropolitan area. If you jump ahead to page 9, we have a proposal to try to identify conservation reserve lands in order of ranking of ecological importance. We know that we've heard a lot about how a lot of CRP lands have been expiring from protection because they're temporary easements. And so in order to prioritize our efforts to try to put permanent protection in place on those lands and try to identify the pieces of land that are priority, we want to do a ranking and go through and sort of evaluate them. So that's what this would be. I should point out that the statewide conservation and preservation plan, which I hope all of you have read from start to finish, it's just packed with really great information. And this is a report that was commissioned by the LCCMR last year. And we spent a tremendous amount of time in the commission studying this plan and hearing from the University of Minnesota scientists who helped create it to help us identify strategic areas of importance for our natural resources in Minnesota. And a lot of the plan's ideas are reflected in our RFP and in our proposals. And this idea of prioritizing CRP lands for future protection was one of the things that came directly from the statewide plan. Bottom of page 9 is a proposal that we funded once before, and we want to continue to acquire easements on some unique granite outcroppings down in the Minnesota River Valley. This is an area that the LCCMR was able to go visit, and you'll see it if you look at the, this thing, the biennial report document. You can see a little picture on the top where you'll see the prickly pear cacti in Minnesota that grow in these, in the little shallow depressions in these rock outcroppings. There's kind of little mini deserts, and a lot of rare plant species live there. So it's a really cool place in Minnesota. So we were excited about continuing to try to protect that. Bottom of page 9, we have a proposal for Bowser to enhance the technical assistance needed to maximize the federal Farm Bill conservation program. So how we can connect Minnesota farmers to those opportunities and maximize the federal contributions. 10.9 is the LACON federal reimbursement, which is a pass-through of federal money to protect our outdoor recreation system. Line 10.21, we have a research proposal at the University of Minnesota to look closely at how strategies to remove endocrine disruptors from our state's waters and how to remove them through different technology at our wastewater treatment plants, but also how to reduce the amount of endocrine disruptors going into the water. So they're going to be making recommendations on both of those ideas. And then related to that, at the bottom of page 10, is a study on the impacts on fish from endocrine disruptors in different Minnesota lakes. Page 11, line 13, cooperative habitat research in deep lakes. This, again, came from the statewide plan, and they identified some of our deep, cold lakes in Minnesota as some of the most pristine waters that we need to protect. And this project will look at what are the drivers of change to water quality and habitat in those lakes and how we can look at, you know, what the resources are and how they're threatened so we can try to do a better job of protecting them. 11.25, Science Museum research project to look at what the impact of intensive tile drainage is on hydrologic changes in watersheds. So we can have a little more information on that. Page 12, at the top of page 12, we funded an urban project which will plant a whole bunch of rain gardens in Minneapolis around an impaired lake and try to measure the impact on the water quality of having an intensive citizen-driven effort to have more rain gardens. We can really see what a difference they make, hopefully. 12.19, we're funding a study of the drainage laws, and this again came from the statewide plan recommendation that we really look at what our drainage laws say, and they haven't been updated in many, many years, just to study and see what the possible additions or updates would be recommended. On the top of page 13, we have a couple of proposals relating to invasive species in Lake Superior. One is to do monitoring ballast water discharges out of ships to see what invasive species impacts those have, and then on line 13.15 to test the viability of treating that ballast water while it's in the tankers. And then on 13.21, we want to study an emerging fish disease called heterospirosis.
Very good.
And then at the bottom of page 13, some developing and testing of some barriers to prevent the movement of invasive carp species. Top of page 14, and I'll ask if commission members can help me on this because... We were, it's kind of hard to explain, but we were all kind of wowed by a presentation on earthworms, and who would have thought that? But it was a really interesting proposal that looks at the impacts of invasive earthworms on the productivity of our hardwood forests. I don't know if members want to add anything on that, but it's a really exciting proposal that, you know. You can tell it must have been really good to get us excited about earthworms and their impact on our forests.
I don't know how many species there are.
We have 14.18, a proposal to survey biodiversity in native and restored prairies to assess the impacts of invasive species on invasive species and food sources for grassland pollinators. Pollinators, thank you. That's related to impacts on pollinators. And then we have several energy-related proposals. One on the bottom of page 14 is for research at the University of Minnesota to analyze the MCAG, the Climate Change Advisory Group's recommendations on reducing carbon emissions, but to delve into those more deeply and come back with a life cycle analysis and more detailed analysis of how those would affect policy. Another research project related to energy, 15.3, is to look at detailed climate records for Minnesota and to use those to forecast future climate change in Minnesota and the impact on humans and natural resources. On 15.13, we are funding an innovative project that will, again, it's more of an urban project that's focused on reducing carbon emissions and focused on improving our air quality and water quality through reducing energy usage. And this is an innovative outreach and energy efficiency program that will go to a number of communities around the state and help communities reduce their energy usage in homes. And that's the proposals. You can see on page 15, line 21, we list the administrative expenses for the LCCMR at $1,412,000, and under law it's capped at what percent?
4%.
4% of total expenditures.
51 million.
And The following pages, you'll see mostly boilerplate language that is in every LCCMR bill. There's a couple of new items I want to highlight. On page 17, there's some new language related to restoration requirements. We had an extensive discussion about what are the requirements when we restore prairies for making sure we're truly using native ecotypes and native species, and we ended up with a tiered system that requires in scientific and natural areas, line 17.19, the highest standards of, you know, very closely related and species from within the same county or within 25 miles. And then on the next page, 18.17, in other prairie restorations that are not in SNAs, the seeds and plant material must originate from within 200 miles of the restoration site. And there's some, the other new language I'll point out is page 18, line 23, just making sure that restoration plans are consistent with the highest quality conservation and ecological goals, and that on page 19, that when we have when we acquire new land, that there is a restoration plan as part of that proposal, and that we have funding in mind, that that's part of the proposal, so that there will be, that restoration will be funded for the long term, so we don't just buy land and let it sit there in an impaired state, that we actually have a long-term plan for restoring it. The other language was in the previous year's LCCMR, except for one other paragraph I want to point out, and that's on the top of page 20, on line 20.3 to 20.6. We did put in some preference language so that in restoration projects, we want to give consideration to using the Minnesota Conservation Corps to staff those projects, to do on land restoration projects. And then on the very last page, under carry forward, there's three work program amendments that the commission made that are for three different projects that needed a little bit of additional time to finish their work. So that's the bill, and maybe I'll just see if there's any questions at this point or comments.
Questions for the senator? If not, Senator, you being as the person who's representative on both LCCMR and the Lessard Outdoor Heritage Council, can you tell us how you kind of seen the relationship between the two develop?
Mr. Chair, that's a really great question. And I have to start by saying I wasn't sure if I wanted to do both of these because it's a really big time commitment. And I really appreciate the support I've gotten from the LCCMR, who kind of encouraged me to stay because they wanted to try to have some continuity between the two councils. And I would say that that hasn't really happened yet, but I think everyone intends on both of these bodies to try to work together in the future. The Lessard Council has, you know, we're kind of on different schedules. The LCCMR pretty much finished our work in January, and the Lessard Council was just starting its work, and the Lessard Council has an extremely difficult job to accomplish because it's such a short timeline, and it's starting from scratch. And so the Lessard Council's been very, very busy just trying to hear proposals and make funding recommendations and hasn't really had enough time to sit back and think about how do they relate to the other constitutional funds. And, you know, the LCCMR has, members have started to have some discussion about whether our mission will remain the same or will it evolve in relationship to the other constitutional funds that have been created. So it's kind of the beginning of that rather than the end. And I think we really would welcome ideas and thoughts from legislators about that as we move forward, because, you know, people are asking, how do these, you know, what belongs in the Clean Water Fund? What belongs in the LCCMR? What belongs in the Lessard Council? I know Jeffrey Broberg and some others came to the Heritage Council with a proposal that was research-related, research on groundwater, and a lot of members of the Lessard Council said, oh, no, we don't do research. That's for the LCCMR. And so we need to have that discussion, and maybe, I don't know, I'm just throwing this out, maybe at some point everybody who is a decider on any of these funds should all get in a room and hash this out and talk it over, but we haven't really had a chance to do that. So it's a great question I don't have the answer to.
Okay. Thank you. And Senator Torres-Rae.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Anderson, I really would like to encourage the committee to do that. It has been very difficult for me to really put my arms around all of this, and I'm particularly concerned about water and all of these things that I see here that overlap. And I'm just having a very hard time figuring out who's responsible for what and how do we look into these categories of funding, for instance, that are included in this in terms of priority. So when you look at this particular bill that you're presenting, my question every time I hear, you know, the category is how this category fits within the need. So do we have an idea of the needs that exist for the state of Minnesota? And if we say that we are spending, you know, $2 million for surface geological information and acceleration of county geologic atlas program, does that mean, is this all we need, or this is just for 10% or for beginning? So I think one is this whole concept of the LCCMR, the LASAR Council, all of these new funding. That's one thing. And then the second piece is how all of these pieces that we're recommending fit within the priorities for the state of Minnesota. And so are we taking care of the entire need, or when we decide that we're going to provide this funding, we're taking care of 10%, 5%, 20% of the need? And I'm just very confused with that.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, and talk a little bit to that point. When the Environmental Trust Fund was formed, there was a very conscious effort that it would respond to requests from the citizens of the state, and that's something LCCMR has done since the Environmental Trust Fund was formed, was try to reach out to the citizens to listen to our citizens of what they would like to see their Environmental Trust Fund money spent on. So we have done regional meetings, we've done little local meetings, we've taken in ideas through the internet and websites and letters, and that's what we use to try and establish the priorities for the next year's funding. So we try to listen to what people are telling us, plus what we also see as members, our needs of the state. We try to meld those two together. And we might end up with really good few priority areas we think we're going to focus on, but then we put those out for requests for proposals. We don't always get good proposals in on all of the what we think are priority areas. So what we feel is the priorities tempered with what citizens are telling us, but then we also have to get good responses from proposers before we'll fund them. So I don't know if that helps with how this process has worked with the Environmental Trust Fund or not. But
and Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Anderson.
I appreciate Senator Frederickson's kind of historical perspective on that. That's really helpful. All I would add is to say that, you know, our job with the LCCMR has always been, you know, we've been the only fund for natural resources, and so we don't have just one mission. It's to restore and enhance and protect all the state's natural resources. Now, the landscape has changed with the passage of these new funds that are a lot more money and for more specific purposes. So that's what Senator Saxhog was getting at. How does that change things and how do we interact? But, for example, you mentioned the geologic survey, and you know, we've had a lot of discussion in the LCCMR about the need to do more test wells for groundwater around the state, that we really don't have adequate information about the state of our aquifers in some parts of the state and how much water is in them and whether it's being depleted. And so we've tried to fund that a couple of times, but we've never had. If we wanted to do all of the need, we would used up all our money just on that. And so we tried to do a few different. We tried to have some strategic priorities in different categories, but so we don't want to be all things and dilute what we do. But we also don't want to just do one area of importance. And this has been an area where we put significant money in over, but it's not enough to meet the need. Now with the Clean Water Fund, perhaps that may be something we decide we should use Clean Water Fund to do the whole thing, because we're going to have more money able to do that. And so that's why I think this is an evolving discussion about what the roles of these different funds are. But at least we have more money at our disposal. But the LCCMR has always been, as Senator Fredrickson said, based on the RFP process rather than just trying to look at existing programs and how to improve them. We've really tried to look at creative things that are being done around the state. And this plan is an effort to help us identify where the needs are around the state and what we should focus on. So this has a lot of those outcomes that I think you're getting at that we need to work towards. But we've never had enough money in the LCCMR to accomplish it all on a yearly basis. Let me add one other thing. We had a lot of discussion in our meetings, especially in the last few months, about jobs and a dialogue about how, you know, we can protect our natural resources, which is what our constitutional mission is. But is there a way we can also put Minnesotans to work at the same time with those green jobs? And so we've tried to identify what some of the projects that are in here, what the job creation component of that is as well, because that's another way it can benefit Minnesotans and let people know that their money is being put to good use. So we'll try to get some more detailed information on that as we move this bill forward.
Senator Perrizzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Torres-Ray, in addition to all the things that everybody has commented, there are a lot of proposals to LCCMR that were research proposals, and some of them are data collection from some of the major users of the data as well as the originators of them by federal and state agencies. And so we continue to fund the ongoing collection of that because it's incomplete as long as things are constantly changing, as well as many projects that are other kinds of research, maybe through the university or some other group, would have stages, and so they might be funded in stages as well. So I can see sometimes there might be a matrix between the two commissions, but at some time I always think that could also lead to the creation of a conflict eventually of whose money gets used where and what the projects are that you'll split up for each particular commission. But at any rate, they're not colliding yet.
Senator Vickerman.
Well, I just want to remind people that are listening this. When we first started out with the LCMR, and then we changed that to have citizens on this committee have equal rights, just as much a vote as I do by serving on the committee, so we get that broad perspective, and not just all political, but there are people from outside the state, from all around the state. And so we have that, Senator. We have that touch with. We could spend, I couldn't even count how much money we could spend if we needed to, but we don't have it. We spent hours and hours and hours. Finally, my wife says, I'm going to send somebody up there with you to figure out what the heck you're doing.
Maybe
a
camera.
Can't be spending all that time, but we have. We start in the morning, goes late, because these are very, very particular projects. And they're good projects. So I just wanted to put that out there. We do listen to the citizens. They have a vote just like I do. And we come out with some good things, I think.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And building upon the last couple of comments, maybe it would be good for members who are not on the commission and maybe even public to maybe either you or Ms. Thornton could go through what a typical year cycle, funding cycle of the LCMR looks like. What month do we start? What's the process? The RFPs, proposals, tours, et cetera. Just so we get a flavor of when the process starts for LCMR and then how we end up at this point with the bill.
Senator Chaudhry, Mr. Mueller just pointed out that was this part of the part of our packet. We have a good outline. Well, I'll ask Senator Anderson maybe to go over that.
Well, I'm going to let Ms. Thornton help to answer that question because she sort of puts this whole plan, the schedule together for us. So why don't
Director
you
Thornton?
Help us with that?
Mr. Chair, members, Susan Thornton, Director of the LCCMR staff, and if I might, I would like to introduce the other LCCMR staff behind me. Shelley Schreffler over here, Michael McDonough, and Mike Banker. And we are your legislative staff. We're housed in room 65 of the state office building, so I hope you would always come to us with any questions that you might have or if there's something that we can help you with. We would be happy to do that and also happy to meet with members on individual questions, projects, and go through the bill again with you or any other ideas that you might have. So with that little soundbite there, as Mr. Mueller pointed out in your packet, we do have an abbreviated schedule that shows the process that the commission went through in this last year to get to the recommendations that you have in front of you today. And we have shifted from the previous LCMR to the new LCCMR from a biennial process to an annual funding process. We are still working to get that process set so that we have a regular time for which we issue a request for proposal. But what we do, and it's also on the back of our summary biennial report here, this is our information gathering that really leads up to the commission issuing the request for proposal. And as Senator Fredrickson pointed out, we have site visits around the state. We ask people in, and people are very generous with their time. We have issue seminars. This last year we talked about natural resources data, invasive species, forest fragmentation, native prairie issues. We were in up around the Grand Rapids area a year ago last summer on talking about forest easements, forest management, and amongst other things. We have been up in the Big Bog area this last year in northwest central Minnesota talking about peatland issues, climate change, outdoor recreation, shoreland management. We were in southeastern Minnesota talking about the interaction of surface water and groundwaters. And we were in the north central area of the state also. And then we have the online citizen input survey and try and hold public forums. Gathering all that together, the commission gets together, adopts a request for proposal that's issued. It's web-based, and actually I will put in a plug. We have a brand new one out for the next funding cycle for funding to begin July of 2010, and that is on the web. But for this package in front of you, we went through the series of issue finding, fact finding, and we issued this last year. It was a little unusual. This package is made up of two requests for proposals that were issued. That was outside of the norm. We issued one for what we called ongoing projects, continuations, those that we felt we had we wanted to continue, and this is a lot of that foundational natural resource data that you have before you, soil survey, county biologic survey, the county geologic atlas, those base foundational data that we need and natural resource managers need for their to do their work, to get up in the morning and do what they need to do. So we issued that request, and for a number of acquisition projects, too. That was issued in June, and then we issued a second one in July that was based more on the statewide conservation and preservation plan. We received that plan that was delivered to the commission July 1. I know a number of you in your committees have heard an overview presentation of the plan. That plan was used very specifically. Those recommendations, we really drilled down into them and issued a second RFP from that. What you see before you is the commission holding a series of hearings on about 60-plus proposals out of the 142 proposals that were received. So we held presentations, we asked people in, talk to us about your project, talk about the outcomes, talking about the budget, and from there the commission, so the about 6 days of discussions, hearings, members talking about the priorities, how these fit in with the plan, with other plans that are out there. And then in November and December, the commission went through the allocations process. And very tough job of getting that, what was still left on the table of $72 million worth of requests down to the $25 million that was available this year for recommendation to the legislature. Some projects are funded in whole. Some were reduced or funded in phases. As always, there were some good projects left on the table. And then we, in January, adopted the legislative bill that is in front of you to put forth as a recommendation from the commission to the legislature with these specific projects in these specific issue areas that are before you. Went through it really fast. It was a year and a half worth of time that I went through, tried to go through in a few moments.
Well, and Mr. Chair, to be fair, I need to mention that the law says we're supposed to have 12 votes on the commission to approve our final package. We didn't have 12 votes this year. But there were some other circumstances in play, and part of it is that there were several vacancies on the commission that had not yet been filled, and in part there was an effort by some, especially by some House members, to change some things in the package because of their concern about focusing more on jobs. I consulted, well, we had a majority of the commission was approved what you have in front of you. We didn't make the changes that were being proposed. I consulted with all the Senate members, and we agreed it made sense to move the package forward as it was approved by a majority of the commission. And I suspect we may have a conference committee on this, but we don't know what the House will end up doing on this bill. So it's the closest we could come to a consensus, and it's very close to that. Last year, as some of you may recall, we didn't finish negotiating this bill with the other body till about 4 a.m. of the last day of session, and we're really hoping that we can move this a little quicker than that. That's one reason why I really wanted to get this bill through the committees as quickly as possible now, so that we can try to encourage the House to move forward as well.
Thank you, Senator. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Any other testimony that we need to hear? If not, Senator Anderson, how would you like to proceed here?
Mr. Chair, I would move then that Senate File 1012 be recommended to pass and referred to the full Finance Committee.
Okay. Motion by Senator Anderson that the that this bill, Senate File 1012, be approved and sent to the full Finance Committee. Any discussion on that? If not, all in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Great. Thank you very much.
It'll be sent to the Finance Committee. Thank you, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, members. Mr. Chair, can I ask you to start the PUC overview, and I'll be back shortly?
Thank you. All right. Next, we have the Public Utilities Commission budget presentation. Mr. Haar.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. My name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission.
Mr. Haar, I think we, in terms of the microphone there, I think you're getting directly into it. So just,
okay.
I think you'll be fine.
I do. Do we have time to crank it up? Otherwise, I can just, I have a PowerPoint on a flash drive, but I can just work off the handout. I believe you have a handout, too, if you're strapped for time.
What's the pleasure of the committee?
Any,
where's the handout?
Strong feelings?
I don't see the handout.
You don't have a handout.
Oh.
Well, if we, yeah.
Should be handout.
We need the handout. There's no question about that.
Handout's fine.
And then if that's fine, then that's the way we'll proceed.
I haven't talked to unions. Tell them to take a breeze.
You go and do it. So did you?
So start 13 to see me this afternoon.
Mr. Chair, I'll just start with some of the general stuff. And
go ahead, Mr. Hart.
Proceed to the budget part. Hopefully, I'll have the handouts at that time. Commission is responsible for regulating three cornerstone industries in the in Minnesota. As Diane Wells mentioned, we regulate the telephone, telecommunications, local telephone services in Minnesota. We work with benefit from the efforts of the Department of Commerce on that. We also regulate retail electricity and natural gas. The handout indicates that these industries together comprise about $7.5 billion in gross operating revenues in the state, so they're a significant part of the state's economy. The Commission's statutory duty is to ensure safe and reliable, reasonable rates and safe and reliable service. Also, as of 2005, the Commission was vested with the authority to approve large energy facilities in the state of Minnesota. And also, the Commission is to foster effective competition in the state of Minnesota. Before I proceed any farther, I should mention, because I forgot to do this in our last budget hearing, with me today is Mary Jo Jasecki, who is our Administrative Management Director here, in case there are any tough questions. And our Chairman, David Boyd, was here a few minutes ago. He had to go to another meeting, but he was here earlier.
So welcome, Ms. Jasecki.
In terms of core functions, besides responsibility for just and reasonable rates and approval of large energy facilities, the Commission has authority to establish broad utility policies through its rulemaking process primarily. We also are involved in resolution of party-to-party disputes, also mediating consumer complaints, as was mentioned earlier also. We also try and provide a forum for public discussion on issues of interest in the utility and telecommunications area. And more recently, we have become far more active in representing Minnesota's interest in regional and national forums. And I'm particularly here speaking of activities related to the Midwest Independent System Operator, which was the organization that's responsible for the operation of the electrical grid in our part of the world. It's actually a 14-state region spanning from Pennsylvania and Ohio to Montana and south to Missouri. So it's quite a large area. The structure of the commission is fairly simple. We have five commissioners. They're appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. I've listed there in the handout the current commissioners. As I said, Commissioner Boyd was with us until just a few minutes ago. Also provided a link there for you if you want to learn more about their backgrounds. I'm sure some of them you know fairly well. The commission is structured to have a fair amount of independence. It's deliberately structured to have independent decision-making authority. But with that independence also goes a significant degree of accountability. And specific standards of conduct, and some of the various elements of that I've listed in the handout. I won't take time right now to go through them, but gives you an idea of what's involved there. The commission also has somewhat of a unique role among state agencies. I'd say our role is very similar to other state regulatory commissions. It's really not that much different compared to those, but in terms of other state agencies, we're somewhat unique in that we have elements of all three sort of branches of government. We are quasi-judicial in resolving party-to-party disputes, setting rates, and so on, as the commission does, spends a lot of time doing. We also have legislative-type functions, mainly when the commission is involved in establishing rules that have application across an entire industry. And we also have some administrative responsibilities stemming from our authority to conduct investigations and mediate consumer complaints. So sort of turning to budget matters now, the main issues affecting us in an operational sense are listed in the handout there. Certainly our workload is by far the most pressing matter. We have a sustained high level volume of filings and consumer complaints in both areas. And also our workload is more diverse, more complex in recent years. It has grown to be more diverse and more complex. We, for example, we currently have four major rate cases pending, We have two more that we are expecting. One we're expecting in a couple of weeks, and another one we believe is about a month out. These rate cases have become more common now, and they become far more complicated, particularly, I guess, mainly because of what's happening in the energy area and the electricity industry in particular. We also, as I mentioned, the Midwest Independent System Operator is responsible for the planning and structuring of the transmission grid that affects service in our state and in all the other states in its 14-state footprint. So we need to be present and representing Minnesota's interests in their activities because their activities have a very significant impact on us. And also, stemming from that, there are a number of transmission initiatives right now looking at, for example, how do we satisfy our renewable energy standards and what is it going to take in terms of transmission facilities to accomplish that. There are lots of different ways it could be done. They each have a price tag. We're trying to figure out what are the most viable options, what are the price tags, how do we split up the costs, those kinds of things. So, and that was work we weren't doing 5 years ago. I mean, that wasn't on our radar screen. Also, a big factor as far as operations are concerned have to do with just providing electronic transparency for what we're doing. We've implemented an electronic filing system whereby utilities can submit their documents electronically now. Parties can go in and retrieve all public documents electronically. The system isn't perfect, but it works pretty well. We're just now trying to embellish it. We have a major initiative underway to try and make that more user-friendly and have greater functionality. But that's an ongoing effort on our part to try to make sure that we're as transparent as we can be and we can provide that information to stakeholders. And I might add that we work very closely with the Department of Commerce on that. Department of Commerce is the primary record keeper for the commission. They are the ones that operate the electronic system that I'm talking about. So we rely on them and work very closely with them. Also, we're, I guess, like every other state agency, we're trying to develop our staff resources for the long term. We're an agency that's been blessed with very low turnover, and that means that a lot of our staff members look like me. They've got gray hair, and they're not that far away from retirement. And, you know, that's a blessing, I guess, in one sense, in that we have a fair amount of institutional memory, and that's all valuable, but we need to build bench strength, and we need to get experienced people and qualified people in place to carry on this important work, and that's a major issue for us. Our budget is fairly straightforward compared to most of the budgets I'm sure that you look at. We have kind of two general components, the general fund budget, which is our operating budget. That's about the same as it was last year. It's $10.9 million for the biennium. The vast majority of that are salaries and rent. I think that if you add salaries and rent together, it's about 93% of that. We recover almost 100% of that through our assessment authority, so that is fee-funded. In the special revenue category, we have two components there. The telephone assistance plan is by far the largest component of the special revenue fund. That is a fund, of course, that provides and funds credits to low-income families to help keep telephone service affordable for them. And then we also have a revolving fund for administrative hearings. As you can imagine, we rely to a significant degree on services from the Office of Administrative Hearings for our evidentiary proceedings, contested proceedings. Basically, when the commission has something that has a contested proceeding, we refer it to the Office of Administrative Hearings. They hold the public hearings. They hold the evidentiary hearings, develop the record, refer the matter back to the commission, and then the commission takes it from there. So we have a very close working relationship with OAH, and that revolving fund is intended to help provide funding for the services that we really absolutely need from them.
Excuse me, Mr. Hart. Yes, Senator Rummel, do you have a question?
No.
Okay. Go ahead. Thank you.
Sure. Priorities for our budget use are listed on slide 10, I guess it is. Inform timely and clearly articulated orders, decisions, that's always our foremost goal. That's kind of our main work product is issuing well-defined orders that set forth not only the commission's decision but the rationale for that decision. Also, a system for user-friendly system for prompt and thorough resolution of consumer inquiries and complaints. We also want to continue to try and be effective in representing Minnesota's interests in regional and even national forums. That's become more and more of a commitment for us. Enhanced accessibility to information about what we're doing. This gets back to the electronic access issues I was talking about. And a stable and productive staff are main priorities for budget use. Our most pressing budget issues, then, are the staff resources. Basically, how do we manage our workload as that becomes more diverse and more complex, and as we attempt to replenish staff expertise over the longer term? That's a major challenge. Many of you know that Minnesota's commission staff size is one of the smallest in the country. I've done a sort of an annual update on this, and if you look at it on a per capita basis, if you look at our staff size compared to other state commissions on a per capita basis, we rank, the last time I did this, we ranked 47th out of the 50 states. And if you add in the folks at OES that do the work, that work with us on this, we probably jump up to 43rd. We're not overstaffed in Minnesota when it comes to regulatory resources. Another major pressing budget issue is technology. Already talked about that. I won't belabor it. And I've listed here technical audits and investigations. Increasingly in recent years, there have been instances where the commission has needed to look at different kinds of utility systems or services that go well beyond the expertise that of our staff or that of commerce. For example, metering technology is one example. Transmission technologies are others, and I'm sure the list could go on. And what we have found is that we need to have the ability to call on the expertise, specialized expertise, when we face these situations. And what we've proposed is a change item that would create an audit and technical investigation funding mechanism. And basically it's structured so that we would go to the Office of Minnesota Management and Budget would serve sort of as the bank, I guess you could say, for us. And when the commission has the need to develop or pursue a specialized investigation of some sort and needs outside specialized consulting services, we would make a request to the Office of Management and Budget, and we would get the authority to proceed with that expenditure. We would then assess those, recover those costs through our assessment authority, and return those funds to the general fund, MMB, once the process had been completed. So that is a change item for us. We feel it's necessary, again, because our work is becoming more complex. There's more at stake. Our staff resources are small. We're trying to do everything we can to get the most out of them. This is one measure we think will help supplement that. That's all I have to say in terms of my formal comments, I guess. I'd be happy to try to answer questions, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you very much, Dr. Haar. Senator Fredrickson?
Madam Chair, Dr. Haar, your general fund, your budget is $10.9 million.
Right.
And the little note says 97% is recovered under assessment authority. Where does the other 3% come from?
We just don't recover it. There are caps. Caps on how much we can recover per company, and in some rare occasions we will go up to that cap, so we'll exceed that cap, so we just can't recover that that full amount. So it varies. Sometimes it's 99%, but it's probably right around. We don't recover 100% every year because of that cap, because of the cap on gross operating revenues.
So in order to increase your staffing, that would have to be the legislature would have to appropriate additional money to do that? And then would that cap have to be changed?
Madam Chair, no. No, the cap really wouldn't affect the cap. It would just, okay. You would have to approve an increase in our budget. The cap applies per company. And in some instances, if they have an unusually large amount of volume activity before the commission, we may come up to that cap for that company, and therefore, if we exceed it, we can't recover anything beyond that. It's just a safeguard, I guess you could say, that was built into the assessment authority to put a limit on how much any one utility would have to pay.
So,
but no, it would be a matter of increasing our budget to allow for additional FTEs. Now, I might mention that we did initially make a request for additional funds way back in August or September or whenever it was we did that. But when things turned so dire with the economy, the commissioners just felt now was not the time to be asking for more, so they said we should withdraw the request.
Okay. Are you involved in the smart grid efforts in any way with the federal stimulus money, or is that going through a different channel?
Madam Chair, we're not involved in any of the funding dimensions of it directly. I mean, we're not seeing any funding, if that's where your question is going. We have some responsibilities to look at the potential for smart grids and to find out what kinds of technologies might be out there, how it might be implemented in transmission systems. We do have some dockets open on that. And as a matter of fact, I might mention that on March 24th, I think it is, we are having a presentation on a smart grid project that Xcel has implemented in Boulder, Colorado. It's an experimental project that they've gone forward with, and the commission has asked that they come in and give us an idea of what what's involved in that. So, yes, we have proceedings underway. We're looking at it, trying to get our hands around how it might be implemented.
Thank you. I wonder, are they bringing in people from Colorado for that?
I'm not sure if they're going to actually be from Colorado. I was assured that the person that is going to be there is very knowledgeable.
Okay. I was just wondering if that would be something not our committee, but perhaps the policy committee should try to piggyback on that. That would be a good presentation for us to see as well.
That would be great. You'd mm-hmm. be most welcome to come.
Thank
That'd
you.
Wonderful.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Dr. Hart, I'd like to ask you a much more general question, not necessarily related to your budget. But as you see utilities coming in for rate increases and they now have significant, say, wind power, wind generation versus a base plant, how do you see the comparison of cost of producing energy from wind generation versus traditional base plant, and how is that relationship changing, or have you seen it change?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, I have seen it change. Wind generation has become far more cost competitive. In the earlier days when the technology was not as well developed, it was higher, it was more costly, but that has changed. Wind generation is now a competitive option. It certainly is in the mix, and it's going to be in the mix to a much, much greater degree in the future. Probably the main challenge facing wind development right now is building the transmission systems to get it to float. With Minnesota's renewable energy standard, we're going to have to build a lot more windmills than we already have. If a national wind energy or renewable energy standard is established, we're going to have to build a lot more beyond that, and the transmission systems are going to have to be substantially revamped and upgraded to be able to accommodate that. So that, I would say, is the main factor right now that's affecting wind development, but I see it becoming increasingly a part of the portfolio and a competitive option.
Senator Kubley?
Well, I'd like to ask a follow-up question to Senator Fredrickson's question, Dr. Haar. I guess, does that continue to be true with, it seems like a pretty short time ago that we could put up a megawatt of wind for about $1 million today. That's nearly doubled in cost. So, I mean, would your comments that you made about wind becoming competitive still apply if it were under construction today and coming online?
Director Haar.
Madam Chair, Senator, well, I'm sure the construction costs, the technology has changed. The size of the generators have changed. They've gone up substantially. So the cost of individual units have gone up. The availability of generating technology is an issue. That's affected the price. So, I mean, your points are well taken. The costs for investors are significant. I was speaking mainly as wind and as a renewable generation source and as a compared to other sources of generation, and I see it as a very competitive option. It's not to say that, you know, the individual project development costs haven't changed. I'm sure they have, and until some of these supply chain issues can be adequately addressed and the delivery system issues, as I was talking about, can be addressed, I don't see that changing.
Well, Madam Chair and Dr. Haar, does the PUC know how much of the generation capacity for wind that's out there is eligible for the federal credit?
Madam Chair, yeah. Senator Cooley, I don't know that right off the top of my head. No, I don't. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Cooley, do we know what the new federal credit exactly is going to look like? I'm not clear on how they've changed it.
Well, I think it just went up, Madam Chair. I'm not sure that it's still not applicable to any kind of income.
But I think they broadened it from purely passive income. But I'm not sure exactly how
they broadened it from passive income, but my understanding is that it's still not available to individuals. So.
Okay. So it'll have, there'll still be big barriers for us, small developer to get a project off the ground in Minnesota in that regard to access that. Senator Pariseau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Haar, what is your take on the CapEx 2020 dispute about wind only versus possibly Big Stone eventually coming on or any other source that's not wind? Anything else that's not wind, that's the point. That is the catch that I'm hearing at all the meetings I go to.
Good luck.
Madam Chair, Senator Pariseau, both of those are still active dockets for the commission. So, number one, so I probably shouldn't comment on that. And, as I said before, having an opinion is above my pay grade, so I leave that for the commission.
Listening to him is within my pay grade, even if I don't offer an opinion.
So are we, Dr. Haar, are we making the whole electricity regulation system far more complex than it used to be? I mean, or not just us making it with all of our new laws, but there's a lot of things happening, a lot of activity. I mean, if we move towards a cap and trade, as we, if we have a national portfolio standard, I mean, all those things, is this going to change and increase the complexity and the workload of your agency, or is this all just you've dealt with big things before, and it's not, you can handle it.
Madam Chair, well, I hope we can handle it, but I don't see it going away. I think your point is very well taken. Yes, it is increasing the complexity. We had a system for many years where the individual utilities had their own service areas and kind of took care of their own resource needs, and once in a while sold power to some of their neighbors, but pretty much ran their own systems, and everything was fine. But growth continued, energy demand continued to grow. And we started to realize, well, there are efficiencies for broader kinds of interchanges, and that's where the need for this larger integrated transmission system came about. And now we're facing a situation where there is greater integration. What we do here affects power that's delivered out in Ohio and points east. It's a much larger system, we've brought about now or required the use of, and the market really has brought about, other generation options. It's not just the old standby coal or nuclear or natural gas. We have a wider array. That's made it more complex because each have their own technology issues, each have their own rate issues, each have their own cost issues. So Yes, it is more complicated. The environmental effects of energy use. There's no energy source really that doesn't have some environmental effects. Some of them are quite different, but every energy source has some environmental effect. Those are now far more on the front burner and have to be taken into account. So it's a more complicated business, indeed.
Other questions?
Then I'll ask one more from a different direction, too. In your opinion, will Yucca Mountain ever be open? And when?
My lifetime, Senator, or Senator Frederickson? Boy, I don't know. There was a time when I thought it would, and I guess that's still my hope because, quite frankly, my personal opinion here, and this is not the commission speaking of, but my personal opinion is that we have to look at all generation options. Nuclear is not going to be on the table until there's some storage solution. And whether it's Yucca Mountain or other options out there, I don't know. I'm less certain now, I guess, on Yucca Mountain than I was. I guess I'm continue to be hopeful that we'll find some way of dealing with that.
Madam Chair, Dr. If it's not Yucca Mountain, aren't we going back basically to ground zero, no pun intended? And starting over with another decades-long process, and whatever it's going to be, the local folks aren't going to like it anyway.
Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson, it does become more complex. That is true. I mean, as you are well aware, there have been other options that have been explored, private storage facilities and other options along that line. Whether or not something like that could be developed, I that's again above my pay grade. I don't know. I guess I'm, as I said, I'm hopeful that something can be developed, because if we are going to address our energy needs in a way that's responsible to climate change concerns, I think nuclear has to be part of it. And I'm recognizing all the problems that it entails.
Madam Chair, Dr. One more question. In the speculation about Yucca Mountain, have you seen any date when it might be open for receiving high-level nuclear waste?
Madam Chair, it's too bad Chairman Boyd isn't here, because he is a member of the Nuclear Waste Strategy Coalition, which is probably the most active group on tracking that issue. He probably would know. I don't have an estimate of what that would be.
Well, Senator Frederickson, I'm sure you know, the president's new budget just eliminated funding, or it's proposing eliminating funding.
I did not know.
In addition to other things.
For Yucca Mountain. So I think, I was just thinking as you were asking these questions, for those members who weren't here in 1993 when we, 1994 when we first had that debate about storage, and we're, then the question was, would it open by 1998 or 1999? And here we are, 94, 15 years later, and it seems to be getting more and more unlikely.
Well,
so that makes it even more unlikely. Senator
Madam Chair, I think federal funding for Yucca Mountain was eliminated in 06.
Well, I don't.
They did that in committee, and it had bipartisan support. They weren't getting anywhere with it, and
I think some of the funding, maybe, because it's sort of been on hold. So that's I guess I don't know exactly what exists, but there's still some funding, obviously, in the budget, because I know I've read in the newspaper that that's been proposed to be eliminated by President Obama. I'm not sure how much funding still exists.
Well, Madam Chair, I might comment on that. There is under the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, there is a charge that each and every one of us are contributing to that's going into the Nuclear Waste Fund, and that money goes to Washington, and it's intended for the storage fund. Fortunately, it's being used for other purposes, but that's the intention.
Well, there was a lawsuit on that, and I thought the utilities won that law. No, I forget what happened.
Yeah.
But did the ratepayers win or lose? Did we get some money back on that from the federal government?
Okay.
Do you know more? Do you want to talk? Or just, thank you. Sorry to put you on the spot. Mr. Ahern.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Ahern, and I represent Xcel Energy and have on nuclear issues for a long time. And yet the question of whether or not ratepayers prevailed in some litigation against the Department of Energy, the answer is yes. Xcel back in 1997, actually, just before the federal government was supposed to come and pick up the temporary storage waste at Prairie Island and other places throughout the country, both by statute and by contract, Xcel brought litigation against the Department of Energy on the basis that they clearly weren't, they had no place to put it, and they're going to breach their contract and their statutory obligation. Long story short, that litigation bore on for a decade or more, but just, probably 3 years ago, the Federal Court of Appeals found that the Department of Energy was obligated under that contract and under the statute, and the only question was what the damages were. And so they remitted it to another body for damage claims, and Xcel prevailed, I think, now it's maybe a year ago, on their first set of claims against the Department of Energy, looking to recover the costs that have been borne by Xcel's ratepayers as a result of the failure to pick this up. And I believe the amount was like $117 million. Now, that's still on appeal, but eventually that money will filter back. I mean, I think most people think that the appeals have not been successful in other situations. And there is, frankly, is another suit coming forward to pick up the next batch of ongoing damages. So
if that suit was successful in the end, that money would be returned to Xcel, and that would have to be rebated to ratepayers, presumably somehow?
That's correct.
And so we'd be getting some more of that deficit spending back in our electric bills. So the taxpayers would be paying us, the ratepayers back. Mm-hmm. But do you know the answer to the budget, the Yucca Mountain budget issue? Do you have any idea?
I believe, as you do, Madam Chair, that there has been some funding, but it has never been as much as has either been requested or has, I think, been proposed by the Department of Energy. But I think there has been some amount there.
All right. Thank you. We better move on to the zoo. So if there's nothing further, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So we were just passing out a little newspaper story about the baby armadillo, and I suppose he or she was too little to bring to the committee, but it was kind of fun news. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Peggy Adelman, Chief Financial Officer of the zoo. Lee Emke had planned to be here, and the weather that's hitting the East Coast, he got caught up in that, and he is now not making it back to town until Thursday. So I apologize on his behalf. We're going to try and do a PowerPoint, and if it doesn't work, you're receiving copies, although not pretty color copies, but copies of the slides. What I'd really like to spend time doing, because a lot of you are familiar with the zoo, is maybe talking a little bit about things that we don't talk about as much. The zoo's mission is to connect people, animals, and the natural world. And when we think of the zoo, most of us think about going out to the zoo and seeing the exhibits. And that recreation is a great thing, and it's one-third of the mission that we do. I think learning is lifelong, and I think that learning can be fun, and that's really what we look at the zoo, too. And so I'm going to spend some time today talking about our educational piece. things that the zoo did about 4 years ago was put together a strategic plan. And what's been great is that we've really used this strategic plan to guide our budget decisions. And we're in the fourth year, and every year we go back and look at the goals and things that we laid out. And we've accomplished something in all of the different areas. The strategic plan priorities that we put together included exhibits and facilities, conservation and animal programs, education, the guest experience. And marketing and communications, organizational capacity, and fundraising. Our vision and the vision of the board of directors was to become one of the top 10 zoos in America. And we actually feel that we are well along our way. We set out, it's a 5-year strategic plan. Our goal was to become a top 10 zoo within 10 years. We are now in the process of putting together board members and to start looking at our next strategic plan.
Ms. Edelman, how do you determine whether you're one of the top 10 zoos?
Madam Chair, that's an excellent question because Zagat doesn't do a zoo comparison. But we look at a number of things. We look at how we're viewed in the other zoo community. We look at tourism. Are we top of mind? And when we put together the strategic plan, we actually sat down and we said, okay, let's ask a number of people, what zoos do you believe kind of fit that top 10 list? And San Diego is always one of the top ones, and Disney Wildlife Park. And we don't have the weather to really compete with those. But we also look at things like the Bronx Zoo and Brookfield and Lincoln Park in Chicago and the St. Louis Zoo, and look at conservation programs, look at attendance, and as we go through here on some of the slides, we'll look at some of the things that have happened in the past couple of years that I think are moving us towards that. We actually were named in a wildlife photography magazine as being the top place for wildlife photography. So it's kind of accumulation of those types of things. But I don't believe you'll see a Newsweek ranking of top 10 zoos. The zoo is a state agency. We're not a cabinet-level agency, but we are a full-blown state agency. All of our employees are zoo employees. The director reports to a board, and it's a 30-person board, half of whom are appointed by the governor and half of whom are appointed by the board itself. And then we have a public-private partnership with the Minnesota Zoo Foundation. And the foundation is a 501c3. They exist to raise funds to support the zoo operations and capital. They have their own separate board, and the zoo director serves as their president. We really look at three cornerstones: the biological programs, which are the animals, and conservation, education, and then the zoo experience, which is what we think of as the guest. Right now, we're looking at probably exceeding 1.2 million visitors this year. We look at school children visits. You can look at a number of these statistics. One of the interesting ones down at the bottom, $95 million annual economic impact. And this was a study that we had updated in 2007. And that's an annual impact to the state of Minnesota of the zoo, and that does not include construction projects that we may have. When we're building a major construction project, that increases by tens of millions of dollars. We have about 237 full and part-time permanent employees, and then in the summer, which is our busy season, is really Memorial Day through Labor Day. We add another 50 to 75, and we run a very strong internship program, primarily in biological programs, but also in our education divisions, marketing. And then the retail and the food services are contracted out. in looking at the last full fiscal year, our annual operating budget was about $21 million. Of that, 35% is the state appropriation. 9% are private contributions, and then the rest is earned income. The largest sources of the earned income are admissions and membership. We also have in that other category, it's everything from our concerts to stroller rental to the milk that we have out at the farm that we sell. And then where does the money go? And I really show it two different ways here. The pie chart shows you that the majority is salary and fringe benefits, although that's not as large a percentage as in a number of state agencies where I've worked in the past. And that's because we have 485 acres, and we really are like a small city. And the facilities, as you can see, take up a large percentage of the budget. In that physical facilities, we have the utilities, which can run fairly high at the zoo. We can dial back for our office staff, but we can't dial back the thermostat for the animals. The things that we look at as far as outcomes and in our strategic plan as far as performance indicators are the capital projects, attendance, membership, conservation activities, animal enrichment, education programs actually delivered, guest satisfaction, different awards, and then the fundraising. Capital projects. We completed the Minnesota Trail a couple of years ago. In the past, the Minnesota Trail had really had very little capital investment, and thanks to investment by the legislature, we were able to refurbish that, and it went from a forgotten trail to that summer showing up on our guest surveys as the most popular trail. Last summer, we opened Rush's Grizzly Coast. If you haven't been out there, I encourage you to come. It is an immersive exhibit with sea otters, grizzly bears, and you really do get to see them up close as you do in this picture. A family of wild boar and Amur leopard.
Ms. Edelman, when I was there this summer, the bears were in the water, so they're right next to the glass, and they were just kind of playing in the water. So,
and they spend a lot of time there. We actually have trout that we put in both the pool and along the stream, and they've become fairly adept at fishing. When they first got there, they grew up, they're all orphaned, and they spent their first 2 years at a wildlife refuge in Alaska, and so they really never had to work for their food. But with animal enrichment, we hide food all over the exhibit. So you'll see them climbing trees. You'll see them searching different places for the food. And then with the fish, they weren't sure what to do initially. And so there was a lot of pawing around. But one now in particular has a technique where he'll spot the fish, and then he'll hit it with his back paw and stun it and then turn around and grab it. And he's gotten to be pretty good. At the same time that we were opening that exhibit, we decided we should redo our central plaza area, which is right outside of where this exhibit is. And it used to be fairly dull. There was kind of a sand pit in there. And what we've done with state investment and also with our retail operation and our food service operation investing money really transformed that whole area, and it is now quite lively. This is in the central part, and it's a water feature out of the birch trees. Water is spraying, and then water pops up at different intervals from these little spouts in the ground. And kids actually come to the zoo now in their bathing suits. Mm-hmm. And the retail operation has been very successful because they're located close to there, and they sell towels and sunblock and swim diapers. So it's really been a great place. Right off of this summer, in July, we are opening an entirely privately funded playground. We used to have a playground that was your typical swings and was getting fairly worn. With $500,000 from General Mills and some supplemental money from other private individuals, we're opening the Woodland Adventure. And this is, again, right off of that very active central area. We're having a miniature Split Rock lighthouse. It's all going to be based on nature play. And one of the things I think a lot of people have heard about is nature deficit disorder, looking at how much time children are spending with electronics versus being outside, the No Child Left Indoors coalitions that are forming. And the zoo is a perfect place to really address those issues. With 1.2 million visitors a year, we have kids that we are having in a safe environment with their families, being outside, walking those trails. And this is another way for them to get some of that exercise. Big turtle shell that they can crawl into, a big mosquito to climb on, a lot of ways to run off some of that energy, and seating for the adults in their life who want to sit there and watch. So we look at what have the outcomes been of this various investment. The zoo attendance, as I said, is expected actually to exceed 1.2 million this year. Back the last time we went through a recession, kind of in the 2003, the zoo was on a decline. But because of the investment, we have now been seeing a steady increase in attendance. And the past two summers in particular have been great. If you look at that peak summer season, last year was phenomenal. And attendance in that summer season last summer was 43% over the prior summer year. And the prior summer year had been pretty good because we had opened the Minnesota Trail. Zoo membership has been steadily climbing. And you'll see it's over 35,000 in fiscal 08. In the current fiscal year, we believe that we are going to reach that $40,000 member level. Biological programs, again, a lot of what we do, it's the animal care staff, the animal health staff, behavioral enrichment and training that I had talked about with the bears, with the food. You want to make sure that animals don't get bored where you see the pacing behavior. So we've really looked at things to change their environments, to make things interesting for them, to try and emulate some of the behaviors that you would see in the wild. The other thing that this does is the training piece will help us so that we can examine the animals without putting the keepers in danger, but also without having to dart an animal, for example. So they train the bears to put their paw up. The dolphins will swim up and present a dorsal fin so that you can take a blood sample. So there's been a lot of emphasis the past couple of years in really trying to look at that behavior and enrichment. Conservation partnerships. We do a lot in conservation, internationally, nationally, and in Minnesota. The person wrapped up in heavy winter gear on the right is one of our vets who has been very active working with Department of Natural Resources in looking at the moose population and the decline of the moose population up north. One of the things that excites me are our education programs. Again, over 75,000 students are served annually. We also do a lot with teachers. We do a lot of teacher in-services and training. On our website, we have a lot of information for teachers, both to use in the classroom, but also if they're coming to the zoo for a field trip, things to help prepare the students, things to follow up with the students afterwards. And we develop materials teaching to the standards that are set by the state. We have special event days. We just finished in February. We have French days, Spanish days, German days, and every other year, Japanese days, where students from all over Minnesota who are taking those languages will present posters, will present different presentations. We do a monorail ride in the language, a bird show in the language. And then students from younger classes can come and talk to those older students and see the presentations in the various languages. Math days, trying to get, you know, how many math field trips are there out there? But this is applied math. And so kids come, they get a calculator, and they get problems to solve. For example, the tapir weighs this much, and this is the diet. This tapir only weighs this much. How do you adjust the diet for that tapir? So kids can see real-life applications for some of the math. Zoo Camp, very popular program, run primarily in the summer, actually makes a little money. Mentor program that we go out and look at underserved populations and bring them in. One of the things that isn't listed here but to me is just one of the great successes is a zoo safari program. And this is a program where we get private funding and either all the third graders or all the fifth graders, depending on the curriculum in that particular school district, get a field trip to the zoo entirely paid for. It pays transportation, admission, a special class, monorail, and lunch. And the program started in St. Paul and is still going on in St. Paul, where every third grader gets a field trip that's 100% paid for. Red Wing Shoes pays for their students. Malto Meal in Northfield, Hormel in Austin, and the Coup, we've for years been trying to figure out how to get the Minneapolis School District involved, finally hooked up with the right person, and Target is funding every fifth grader this year to come to the zoo, and providing every student with a backpack and notebook to take notes. And someday when you're really depressed, give me a call because I've got a five-minute video that one of the classes put together that is just, you can't help but smile when you see it.
Senator Faraso, sorry.
I'm sorry, who?
I don't, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Adelman, I noted that on the education school programs, you didn't mention career days. But do you ever use, since I know there's a veterinary tech school in Argosy, right in Dakota County, do you ever use the veterinary techs students and introduce them to some of the things that are possible for them at the zoo or in their career field?
Madam Chair and Senator Paraso, we actually have Argosy students touring the zoo on a fairly regular basis. We also, our vet staff always have externs, and they may come from Argosy. Also, we do a lot of work with the University of Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Fredrickson?
Madam Chair, Ms. Adelman, I was curious about your connection with the Minneapolis school district. Might that have been with Ms. Ingerson that you were able to?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, funny you should mention that. Yes, I had breakfast with the former Commissioner of Finance one day and explained how we had been trying to find the right person because it's a complex school district. And she actually hooked us up with the name of the person who's in charge of all of the science programs in the school district. And we had been working with Target at the same time, and the stars aligned. And it's just, it's been absolutely great.
Good networking.
Distance learning. I had mentioned our online teacher resource. We also have a couple of programs. A few years ago, we started the Zoom Matchmaker program, which teachers can use who are teaching about genetics, where instead of the red pea and the white pea making the pink peas, they actually go in and they will breed tigers for genetic diversity or for disease resistance. And they pick which tiger, they get a little bit of background, and then they don't just do it once, but they have to do it generation by generation by generation, so they see keeping that genetic line diverse is challenging. The National Science Foundation funded a grant for WolfQuest, and we have partnered with Yellowstone National Park. This is something where people go online, and it's real-time video game, but you become a member of a wolf pack. And we have people as far away as India who get online and play this and really learn what it's like to be a member of a wolf pack and how they have to work together to survive. Number of partnerships. School of Environmental Studies is on the zoo site, and we do a lot with those students. We both teach some of their classes, and then their students will help us with animal observation, making enrichment items, those types of things.
Ms. Edelman, we're going to run out of time. I apologize, but you better get to the numbers quick at the end.
Basically, the zoo's budget, as I said, is about $22 million a year. 35% of that is the state appropriation. The governor's recommendation is a 10% reduction, which is just over $700,000 a year. Because the zoo has had a very successful summer, we have tried to be prudent in saving that money so that we can look at this reduction in a thoughtful manner. We believe that we can do the 10% reduction. That will take us from the state support at 35% down to the state support at 31%. That will be the lowest that it's ever been. But again, we've learned to be very entrepreneurial. Things that we're looking at, obviously the things that all state agencies are looking at with the no salary increases for managers or achievement awards, limiting travel to the things that we have to do, for example, accompanying animals, a limited hiring freeze, looking at all major expenditures. For example, we're looking at printing and postage, and are there things that we can do online, our member newsletter, for example. So the zoo believes that we can live with the 10% reduction to the general fund appropriation. However, anything beyond that would be difficult, and we would have to start looking at programs. Again, from an outcome standpoint, we believe that it's been a very successful couple of years. And I tell people that in these trying economic times, I want to be the Buffalo Wild Wings and the Netflix of state government and be the successful. We're on this great upswing. And so far, attendance has – we've been able to maintain great attendance. And we hope to continue to do that.
What fee changes are you proposing? Fee changes?
Madam Chair, at this point, the board has not voted any fee changes. One of the things that we are looking at is going to a seasonal. The zoo has not done that before. And while we're open all year, the summer experience, there is more. The butterflies are there. There are some summer-only exhibits. And so that's one of the things that we're running the numbers right now. If we increased some fees for the summer, we would like to be able to then decrease and go below what we're actually charging now for those winter months.
And I see you're proposing increasing membership fees.
Madam Chair, yes. What we do is we, right now, a family of four, if you come to the zoo twice in a year, it makes sense to be a member. And we look at membership fees at other organizations throughout the Twin Cities, and then we look at what we basically what we think the market would bear and what you get for that.
Well, please keep us posted on the fee decision, the admission fee decision, because I think that's something of great public interest that we will want to be aware of what your plans are.
And Madam Chair, because we are the state zoo, we believe we need to be accessible. And a couple of the things that we do is we do free passes. 10% of the admission fees go out to community action councils. For 2 years now, we've been in the museum pass program, and we are the most popular museum pass. And we're also looking, the zoo safari program, particularly in Minneapolis, has been so successful. One of the things that we're talking about is sending passes home with some of those students so that they can bring their families back, which I think would be a great self-esteem thing for the kids to be able to talk to their families about all the things that they've learned and make the zoo accessible for their families.
Thank you very much. Sorry that we've run out of time, but I think we got all the information we need. So thank you so much for the presentation, and our meeting's adjourned.